Hello, thank you all for joining. My name is Toni Reale, and I'm the Coastal Program Coordinator for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. As part of my position with SACE, I manage a diverse network of environmental advocates, local elected officials, academics, renewable energy business owners, et cetera. And that network is called the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, and you can see our logo here on the slide I just advanced to. This network promotes the protection of the Southeast's uniquely vulnerable coastal resources by increasing local, state, and national awareness of the threats and opportunities posed by global warming. If you'd like to join the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, you could see the link here on the screen. It's www.seccn.groupsite.com. The Southeast Coastal Climate Network covers an area from Maryland to Louisiana, and so if you become a member, and there's no obligation for participation or anything like that, but it's a great way to network with other folks that are interested in the same issues all along the coast, and so we're from Maryland to Louisiana. However, if you live in Florida, we do have a sister group of the Southeast Coastal Climate Network called the Florida Climate Alliance. And that URL is also on the screen here. And I highly encourage folks on the webinar today to sign up for these groups. It's a great way to stay plugged in as to what's going on, a great way to network, and also a great way to find out about webinars such as this one. And the host organization for the Southeast Coastal Climate Network is the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And so this webinar today is really the fourth webinar in a series of webinars that the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy has been doing with ICLE, Local Governments for Sustainability. Is Missy Stoltz on the line? Missy is ICLE's adaptation manager, and typically she joins our webinars, but she does travel a lot. So if you don't know about ICLE, they're a fantastic organization that dials in local governments into issues like climate change and helps provide local governments with the tools and technical consulting and training that they need to be able to implement sustainable development at the local level. So if you haven't heard of ICLE, I encourage you also to visit their website. Now, I am very pleased to present to you or introduce to you today two co-hosts for this webinar presentation. First, we have Dr. Benjamin Horton. He is an associate professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He is also the director of UPenn's Sea Level Rise Research Laboratory and has published over 90 peer-reviewed articles on this topic. Our other co-host is Dr. Ken Lindemann. He's with the Department of Marine and Environmental Systems at Florida Institute of Technology. In agency, academic, private, and NGO positions, he has co-authored more than 50 peer-reviewed articles and two books, and has served on more than 20 spatial planning, fishery, and tourism panels in the Caribbean and in the U.S. And so I'm so pleased to welcome Dr. Horton and Dr. Lindemann. Again, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules to join us today to talk to us about Southeast Sea Level Rise science and adaptation planning in Florida and the Northwest Caribbean. I'm going to go ahead and exit this webinar slideshow here and pull up Dr. Horton's. So Dr. Horton, if you are ready, here's your first slide.
Okay. Thank you, Toni, and welcome, everybody. I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes regarding sea level changes. I'm a geologist, and I've been studying past sea level changes for the past 10 years or so, and I look at sea level changes since the last glacial maximum, which occurred around 20,000 years ago. And these data from the past provide the baseline to really compare with the observations of sea level we have in the 20th century from tide gauges and also satellites. Also, by looking at the past, you can look at regional variability. How does sea level differ in Florida than it does in Maine? How does it differ in Maine than it does in northwestern Europe? So you can look at regional variability, and you can also look at temporal variability. How rapid has sea level changed in the past in response to climate warming? So you can get some sort of indication of the magnitudes that we may expect for the future. So as Tony stated, I'm from the University of Pennsylvania. I head a sea level research unit. I'm willing to answer any questions that I regarding the topics that I discussed today, and you'll see my email on that slide. So you can drop me an email, and I'll reply as promptly as I can. So Tony, could you go on to the next slide, please? So this slide is from the Outer Banks in North Carolina. It's a slide I took in 2009. You'll see somebody on the right-hand side, which is one of my graduate students. I spent a lot of time working in North Carolina, and at least the last 6 or 7 years, this has been my prime research site. And indeed, this is why I was asked to give this seminar. I've given a variety of talks in North Carolina regarding the threat of sea level rise, coastal inundation, coastal erosion. If you look at this slide, and I'm sure you're aware of this by looking at the coastal areas near where you live, that we know that something is happening to our coastal zone. You should not have an image like this. On the right-hand side is the main highway that runs down the Outer Banks. It's then protected by a man-made dune, which failed in November 2009 as a remnant of one of the tropical depressions passed near the Outer Banks. And on the left-hand side, we have a series of coastal properties, and they shouldn't be in the sea. So something is happening. Next slide, please. Now, we know that sea levels are rising. They've been rising in the 20th century. The two driving factors for sea level rising causing the inundation that you saw in North Carolina are the oceans are expanding. So there are two properties to do with causing sea level rise. One is called thermal expansion. So if you increase the atmospheric temperature, which we know has happened in the 20th century, that's going to increase the temperatures of the upper ocean waters, and the ocean waters are going to expand. They occupy a greater volume, and sea levels rise. The second contribution to sea level rise is mass change. So changing water from ice into liquid. Now, this can come from alpine glaciers, small alpine glaciers, or it can come from larger ice sheets. And this is one of the sort of worrying trends that will occur in the 21st century, is that we've been monitoring Greenland melting. So we have a satellite image on this slide that shows in pink the extent of the 1992 summer melt. And you can see a huge increase in the spatial area in 2005. And if you look closely, you can see that this spatial area includes elevations above the 2,000-meter contour for the Greenland ice sheet. Now, when these ice sheets melt, they basically form surface lakes. And on the right-hand side, we have a photo of the melting or the discharge from one of these coastal lakes. The discharge here, this is a crevasse. Basically, the water melts on the surface, plunges down to the base of the glacier, lubricates the base of the glacier, and then it flows into the sea. Now, the volume of this water, this is towards the end of one of the summer melts. At its maximum, it was churning out more water than the Niagara Falls. So colossal amounts of water. The Greenland ice sheet has within it the potential to raise sea levels over 7 meters. Now, this won't happen in the near future. Indeed, one of the huge changes within academia, within science, is the response of ice sheets to temperature warming. Now, if we went back 20 or so years ago, we thought that if you increase temperatures, that the influence on the ice sheets would take thousands of years. So if we're increasing temperatures in the 20th century, we shouldn't see the effect on an ice sheet until maybe 3000 AD. That's now wrong. We now know, and this is a statement from James Hansen, these ice sheets respond not in the order of millennia, but they're really in the order of centuries. So we will see the influence of melting of ice sheets within the next 100 years or so. Next slide, please. We then have Antarctica. The Antarctic ice sheet has existed for millions of years. But we know, again, through looking at geological records, that this ice sheet has waxed and waned. Now, it has been a sleeping giant, really, over the last 10,000 years. Really hasn't changed very much. But we are now noticing that it is starting, as the slide says, to awake. And we have huge contributions potentially from sea level. On the eastern side of Antarctica, if that was to melt, it'd raise sea level 52 metres. That's not going to happen. The eastern Antarctica is very, very stable. However, we are worried about the western Antarctic ice sheet, which contributes around 5 metres, could contribute around 5 metres to global sea level. And we have observations of disintegration in the western Antarctic peninsula, which, if it all goes, will contribute around 0.3 of a metre. Next slide, please. So this slide homes in on the Western Antarctic Peninsula and homes in on areas that have disintegrated in green. So the Antarctic Peninsula, as the slide said, has experienced large chunks of ice shelves have collapsed in the last few years. Temperatures in the peninsula have warmed roughly around 2.5 degrees C over the last 50 years. Now, what I want you to think about is how fast do you think an ice sheet will disintegrate? So I want you to, we're going to focus in on Larsen B, which is the green, one of the green areas with the dark green boundary. It disintegrated Larsen B in 2002. So I'd like you to think about, Larsen B is about the size of Rhode Island. How fast do you think this ice sheet would disintegrate? Do you think it'd take decades? Surely it wouldn't take 12 months. And you'd be lying if you said it was months, and surely it couldn't take days. Next slide, please. This slide shows, from satellite images, shows the Larsen B ice shelf disintegrating within a month. We have an image on the 31st of January 2002. You can see the Larsen B. You can see these dark patches on the surface, which are those glacial lakes. We can then move through to the 21st of February, and you can see some areas are disintegrating. Huge areas a day later on the 22nd, and when the satellite came directly overhead again on the 5th of March, the size of Rhode Island had disintegrated in approximately a month. And that scared the scientific community. We did not expect something like that to happen. Next slide, please. When I talk about alpine glaciers, I'm not really restricting myself to the Alps, but we're talking about high elevation glaciers that have been observed to have melted in the 20th century. So when these alpine glaciers, we have one in 1910 and from the French Alps, and here we have an image of the same aspect, same time of year in 2001. So when these alpine glaciers melt, the meltwater eventually, through the hydrological cycle, will end up in the oceans and will raise sea levels. Next slide, please. And this slide is one of my favorite ones. This has a picture postcard that is in the German Alps in 1906, and then a photograph of that image in 2003. And I'm sure the people who bought this postcard in 1906 and were maybe potentially they were writing to their loved ones a question saying, which do you think will exist in 100 years? This hotel, which is precariously perched on the side of a steep slope, or a glacier that has existed for the last few thousand years? I'm sure the population in 1906 did not believe that the ice sheet could vanish, which is very obvious in the photo in 2003. Next slide, please. So if you're going to increase the volume of the ocean through expansion of the water as it increases in temperature and the addition of meltwater from ice sheets or glaciers, you're going to raise global sea levels. The simplest way to look at the impacts is just to look at low-lying land. So if we have an increase in mean sea level of somewhere around a meter, it's going to inundate this area in the Bay of Bengal, displacing millions of people. Next slide, please. Closer to home, if we look in Florida, we can see areas in blue which are outlined with the red that are areas that are subject to inundation after a 1 meter rise in sea level. And so many of you there will be aware of properties, infrastructure, aquifers that will be influenced, I'm sure Ken's going to talk about later, by a potential rise in sea level. But understanding sea level is not as simple as just raising mean sea level by 1 meter. Next slide, please. And there are a couple of take-home points that I want to get over in the next few slides or so. And one of them is this slide. This slide here shows future eustatic changes in sea level by AD 2100. So there's this term here, eustatic. So eustatic means ocean level. So how much are the oceans going to rise? So if we have a look at this graph, we have on the y-axis, we have sea level rise rates from zero going through to above 200 centimeters or 2 meters. So this graph is a variety of different projections of what's going to happen to ocean sea level, and also importantly, what the mean rate of rise is going to be. So they're giving no spatial variability. They are not suggesting what is the rate of rise going to be in Florida, how will that compare to Maine, how will that compare to London, how will that compare to Sydney, Tokyo, etc. This is the global mean rate of rise. And we have a variety of different assessments here. On the first, on the left-hand corner, we have the IPCC fourth assessment report that was published in 2007. Now, many of you, by looking at the media, may think of the IPCC as alarmists. 99% of the time, the IPCC is a conservative organization. They provide the average estimates, the scientific consensus of what we think is happening to sea level based upon scientific peer-reviewed publications from approximately 2003 up to 2007. And on the basis of that, they came up with a sea level rise assessment of somewhere between around 18 centimeters going up to 59 centimeters by 2100. Now, within this, the contributions are the increases in ocean volume from thermal expansion, from the expansion of ocean temperatures, and the contributions of alpine glaciers. They did not, and I'll state this again, they did not include any melting from Antarctica or Greenland. Now, why is this? Well, that's because between 2003 and 2007, the scientific community did not know how much meltwater was going to come from these ice sheets. They did not know. So instead of producing a guesstimate, they just stated in their report, we're giving you an estimate from thermal expansion and the melting of alpine glaciers. We do not know what the contribution is. So they don't know whether it's going to be 20 centimeters, 1 meter, 2 meter. They do not know. The scientific community didn't particularly like that. They said it was an underestimate. And there have been a variety of different publications in the last 3 or 4 years, starting off with a very famous publication by Stefan Ramsdorf from the Potsdam Institute in Germany, who suggested that sea level rise rates by 2100 were going to be much higher, somewhere between around 0.5 of a meter going up to 1.4. We then have a Grinstead publication in 2009, much larger error bands taking up sea level to some over 2 meters. That's 20 centimeters per decade. And then we have two more recent ones, Vermeer and Ramsdorf in 2009, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Jevers, published in Geophysical Research Letters in 2010. Again, indicating much higher rates than the IPCC, centering at around just over 1 meter. And if you asked me for a ballpark figure of what would happen to eustatic, I would say somewhere between about 0.5 and 1 meter is what we can expect. Next slide, please. Now, the IPCC is thought to be an underestimate. Now, this slide gives you an indication of why. So what we have on here is we have sea level changes going from 1970 to 2010. In the red, we have the tide gauge rates. In the blue, we have our satellite rates. So we can see that sea level has been rising. And we see that as we move into 1990 going through to around 2007, 2008, that the satellite measurements are outside the predicted range of estimates from the IPCC in the gray band. So giving us an indication that the IPCC were too conservative, giving us an indication that Greenland and Antarctica are already contributing to sea level, and that maybe instead of thinking about a 20 to 60 centimeter rise that the IPCC projects, we need to be thinking of a rise of up to 1 meter in eustatic changes. Next slide, please. The second take-home point that I want you to think about is that sea level changes. If you want to understand what sea level, how sea level is changing in Florida or the Southeast, it is very, very complex. You cannot just take an IPCC or a Ramsdorf projection of eustatic and project it for Florida or the Southeast. It is a very, very complex process. And this slide tries to illustrate this to you. So we need to think about a term, RSL, relative sea level, and it's a function of eustatic, which is ocean volume, and we can think of this on this slide as the density changes, the thermal expansion. It's going to be influenced by ocean circulation. Obviously, in Florida, you're influenced by the Gulf Stream. It's going to be influenced by ocean atmosphere interactions. You've got the hurricane circulatory system in the Caribbean. We also will have the changes from ice melting. So you have a very, very spatially variable on eustatic. We then have the second term, which is isostatic. And when I think about isostatic, I think about land level changes. So this is an important concept to try and understand, that when we think about the Earth, you cannot think of it as a brittle solid. If I tried to give you an analogy, how would I think about the Earth? You could think about the Earth similar to a boiled egg, in the fact that you've got a brittle outer crust, which cracks, and we've seen examples of that with the Haiti earthquake, the Chilean earthquake recently. But underneath it, it is a plastic. It is malleable. If you apply to a weight, it will deform. Now, as a geologist, I know when there have been colossal weights on our planet, and they are glaciations. At the last glacial maximum, 20,000 years ago, we had a massive ice sheet over our Earth. And that was centered in North America and also in northwestern Europe. These were colossally thick ice sheets. They were some 4 kilometers thick. So they depressed the land underneath it. So in areas underneath the ice sheet, the land was depressed at the last glacial maximum. When that ice sheet deglaciates, when it vanishes, the land will rebound, and the Earth is continuing to rebound. If you go to the Hudson Bay today, and then you return there in 1 year's time, the land will have risen around 14 millimeters. The land is rising at around 14 millimeters per year. What happens to areas beyond the limit of the ice sheet? Well, at the last glacial maximum, they were elevated, and now they are subsiding. So I'm sat in my office here in Philadelphia. 1 year ago, my office was 2 millimeters higher. Land in Philadelphia is subsiding at around 2 millimeters per year as a result of this ice sheet, and will continue to do so for thousands of years. Next slide, please. So here is a slide that just shows eustasy very, very simply. So here we have on the right-hand side, we have the dimensions of these ice sheets in North America and northwestern Europe. On the left-hand side, we have a graph of showing how relative sea level change has been from the eustatic component. It decreases to the last glacial maximum around 20,000 years ago as water goes from the oceans into the ice sheets. The ice sheets then deglaciate and sea level rises. Next slide, please. So this beautiful image is an image of North America at the last glacial maximum on this slide 21,000 years ago. So what did this slide show you? In the white, it shows you the ice sheet. In the blue is the areas of the oceans, and in the green is the areas. The green and the red are differing elevations. So although it's got a slightly strange projection, you can see the present-day Gulf of Mexico in the black line going through to the Florida. You see the Mississippi Delta, the Florida Panhandle going up the Atlantic coast. 21,000 years ago, the boundary between the oceans and the land is the difference between the turquoise and the green. And so you can see colossal areas of land which are now underwater, going through the Gulf of Mexico, the Florida Panhandle, and the Atlantic coast. Next slide, please. Now, those ice sheets melted, and I've got a series of bullet points here. Colossal changes. When those ice sheets melted, 50 million kilometers cubed of ice from those two large ice sheets melted, raising global mean sea level by 120 meters. And the graph tries to show you this. On the x-axis, we have time from 25 to 5,000 years ago. On the y-axis, we have on one side the sea level going from minus 150 meters to zero. And on the other side, we have ice volume. Now, as we went from around 20,000 years ago, we have sea levels at around minus 120, ice volumes at around 50 million kilometers cubed. Sea level rose at around 10 millimeters per year. The geological data also indicate that this fast rate, 10 millimeters per year, 1 meter per 10 millimeters per year, was also punctuated by very fast changes. So at 2 points at 19,000 and 14,500 years, the rate of sea level rise went up by fivefold to 50 millimeters per year. So again, in the past, we know that as we're melting those ice sheets, they don't melt in a linear fashion. They are punctuated by rapid changes. Next slide, please. So at the end of that fast melting, here we have a slide at around 6,000 years ago. Our ice sheets have disappeared. You don't see any white on here. The North American ice sheet had gone. The Northwestern Europe ice sheet had gone. And our coastlines look much like they do today. So that 10-millimeter average rise dramatically changed the coastline from something that doesn't look like today to 6,000 years ago. You can pick out the North American coastline. You can pick out the Mississippi Delta. You can pick out the Florida Panhandle. You can pick out the Atlantic coast. Next slide, please. This slide tries to, again, reinforce this isostatic land level change. So we have, on the left-hand side, we have a series of times. Time equals 0, time 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So we go from time 0 to time 2 is the build-up to that last glacial maximum. We see that sort of gray to white area is our ice sheet, and it depresses the land. As you go from times 2, 3, 4, and 5, your deglaciation. And today we're at time 4. So the land where the former ice sheet is in Hudson Bay is still depressed. And as I said, today it is rising at 14 millimeters per year. So the influence of sea level rise in the 21st century in Hudson Bay is negligible. We're getting, what did we say from the satellites? The satellites are changing sea levels around 3 millimeters per year, eustatic. But land is changing, uplifting at 14 millimeters per year. So relative sea level in Hudson Bay, sea level's falling. They don't need to worry about it. But where the area was uplifted in areas around B, where we had this uplifting at T2, where we had this forebulge, then when we went through from T2 to T4, that forebulge, the elevated area, is subsiding. And as I said, in Philadelphia, where I live, that subsidence rate is around 2 millimeters per year. So that means that any change in eustatic sea level is amplified in this location. Now, you may say, what's happening to the southeast? Well, the southeast, I would say, is somewhere around location C. It's far enough away from the ice sheet that it should have negligible changes in isostatic movement. So people in Delaware will have a greater land level change than they will in Florida. Next slide, please. Next slide. Okay, so this is some work that we've been doing. So this work here, this is a series of data points, a series of sea level graphs that you see from Sanborn Cove going through to the Outer Banks, North Carolina, and they are showing rates of sea level rise. Okay, so you have changes over the last 4,000 years. So on the x-axis, it's 4321, which is changes in time, 4321,000 years, and changes in relative sea level along the y-axis. Now, in the last 4,000 years, there's been no eustatic changes. The ice sheet's diminished, and all we're left with are Greenland and Antarctica, which didn't really change much for the last 4,000 years. So eustatic is zero. So if we think about that equation, relative sea level equals eustacy plus ice sea equals ocean volume plus land level movement. The ocean volume is zero, so any change in relative sea level is just the result of land level change. And so we've calculated along the Atlantic coast going from Maine, northeast area in zone one, where the land has been changing between around 0.7 of a millimeter per year. We then go into zone two, where we have New York, the Delaware, Chesapeake, where we have land level substance of up to 2 millimeters per year. Sea level has been rising 2 millimeters per year to do with land substance. And then we move further south into the Carolinas, where we return to a lower rate of rise of somewhere around 0.6 to 0.8 millimeters per year. Now, our data stops in South Carolina. Unfortunately, there is no data for Georgia or Florida of an accuracy for us to calculate those rates. And that is a huge knowledge gap for your region. I'll state this again. There is no accurate or precise data of what has happened to sea level over the last 4,000 years for Georgia or Florida. So I don't know what the land level changes are. and I don't know what any temporal variability is. But if we just look at those rates, I want you to look at those rates. They're between around 0.7 and around 1.7 millimeters per year. Next slide, please. So there are geological observations. What do we know about 20th century? Well, we get this information from satellites, in the, such as the TOPEX Poseidon satellite. We get it from tide gauges, and they're of a variety of different forms, very, very accurate radar tide gauges, such as the one in Liverpool, an acoustic tide gauge in Australia, to more historical tide gauges, such as in Venice, and temporary tide gauges, such as the one in Antarctica. Next slide, please. So this slide shows global mean sea level. The 20th century, so the top slide in A shows global mean sea level from 1870, showing an increase around the globe for the average of all the tide gauges, and it gives a rate of around 1.8 millimeters per year. In the subset, we show the rates where we have now got satellite measurements to dovetail, they nicely overlap with the tide gauges, showing an acceleration from 1991 to 2003 of 3.1. I then downloaded one of the tide gauge rates for Florida. This is Key West, showing a rate greater than the global average of 2.24. Now, the question is why? I can't tell you what the land level movements are, whether that's contributing to it, because we don't have the information. It is certainly an area of interest to try and understand why is the Key West gauge slightly higher than the global average. Does it have to do with thermal expansion? Is there a warm pool around Florida? Is it to do with ocean circulation associated with the Gulf Stream? Next slide, please. Now, these are the tide gauges along the Atlantic coast for the same spatial areas we had geological estimates. And so one of the things, again, I imagine if you've logged into this webinar, maybe you have been concerned by some of the comments or the criticisms of the IPCC, but you also believe that climate is changing. But conversely, there may be people on this webinar who are skeptical about climate change. And what I, as a third sort of take-home point, is that I wanted to show you geological observations of sea level against, over the last 4,000 years, against observations of sea level in the 20th century. There's no models involved. This is data versus data. Our geological observations were between around 0.7 to 1.7 over the last 4,000 years. In the 20th century, all of these tide gauges show rates that are greater than that, going from the northeast at around 2 millimeters per year in the central part, because we've got land substance which gives this relative sea level change of nearly 4 millimeters, going as we go further south to around 3.7. Next slide, please. Again, to drum home this data, this comment, we have another graph. We have latitude here going and running down the Atlantic coast, and then we have the locations of the tide gauges going from Eastport, Bar Harbor, Portland in the northeast, going through Baltimore, Annapolis in the mid-Atlantic coast, going through to the southern Atlantic coast of Charleston, showing some of the Florida ones such as Miami Beach. In the black, we have the rates of sea level rise in the last 4,000 years due to isostatic substance. In the red, we show the rates of sea level rise in the 20th century. It includes isostatic substance but has a contribution from eustatic. The ice sheets and the alpine glaciers are melting. There is no overlap in this data with the areas of control. There is a clear difference between the 20th century and the last 4,000 years. This is data versus data. There is no doubt that sea level is rising. Next slide, please. And just to, it hasn't come up. Oh, that's unfortunate. It has come up. So if we look at this final slide to drum up this point, we have another XY scatter plot. We have tide gauges along the x-axis, their rates of sea level rise, and then we have the last 4,000 years along the y-axis. So if there was no change in sea level, these data points would lie along the solid black line showing no rise, because the tide gauge rates in the 20th century would equal the late Holocene rates. But we find that they lie beyond the 1 millimeter line. They lie somewhere between the 1, 2, and 3 millimeter line. If you take an average, the difference between the 20th century and the late Holocene is around 1.8 millimeters per year, conforming to the global average, although there is some spatial variability, and we've seen that the Florida gauge is slightly greater than this 1.8. Next slide, please. Do we have the next slide?
Do you not see it? I see it on my screen.
I don't see it on my screen. I see that graph. So the next slide is the summary. I mean, I have the presentation in front of me, so I can just run through those. If everyone else can see it, then that's fine. If there's just something up with mine, just let me get my presentation up.
If I can fix it, I apologize.
Well, hopefully everyone can see the summary take-home points, and I've basically written out 7 bullet points. First of all, the geological data says that global sea level rose around 120 meters from the last glacial maximum 21,000 years ago, and it stabilized around 4,000 years ago. There was no eustatic input. So from 4,000 years to the turn of the ninth, between the 19th and the 20th century, sea level didn't change very much eustatically. It was driven by the isostatic changes. The instrumental record suggests that the change in sea level occurred at the turning into the 20th century. Our estimates pick out somewhere between about 1890 AD to around 1910 AD. We had an acceleration in sea level. Estimates for 20th century show that the global average eustatic rate is around 1.8 millimeters per year. Satellite observations suggest an acceleration to 3 millimeters per year. For the future, sea level is projected to rise at an even greater rate, the eustatic rate. So again, take-home point, it's a eustatic change. The IPCC, Ramsdorf, etc., has a range of somewhere between 22 and greater than 2 meters. I think that this is going to be greatly constrained in the future, but there are reasons for this variability. Things we don't know about global populations, things we don't know about the relationship of ice to temperature. But as a take-home point, I would suggest that a raise around 0.5 to 1 meter for Florida would be appropriate. When we think about the changes of sea level, we know what the causes are. Global sea level rise are the result of thermal expansion of water, the water expands as it warms, and the loss of land-based ice due to increased melting. Final slide. So I'd just like to thank you all for listening. And as I said, I'll take any questions. The final take-home point is that if you want to understand sea level change in your region, in the southeast, be it Florida or wherever else that you are concerned about, you must know what the contributors are, the global components, particularly these ice sheets, alpine glaciers. You need to know what the regional and the local trends are. And unfortunately, there are very few areas in the Earth that we know these regional and local trends, and certainly for the Florida and the Southeast, we do not. And therefore, if you want regional to local projections in the future, you need to solve that problem. I'd like to thank the National Science Foundation and indeed two of my postdoctoral students. I'm stood in the center. We have Andy Kemp on the left and Simon Engelhart on the right. And they said, perhaps maybe people should work in North Carolina, because when we're working in North Carolina, we're working in a location called sea level. It's 27 miles from this point, and it also tells us where the Atlantic Ocean is. Okay, thank you. So now it's over to Ken.
Thank you so much, Dr. Horton. That was an excellent presentation. And we'll, again, take questions at the end. I'm going to go ahead and load up Dr. Lindemann's presentation. Ken, here's your first slide.
Thank you. I note that I believe the time is approximately 12:42, so I will try to accelerate. I also note that I don't have an email address on this first slide, so for the folks that are interested, it's simply Lindemann, the spelling of the name, at fit.edu. Next, please. Two assumptions. Conservatively, there will be a 0.5 to 3 foot sea level rise by the end of the century in this region, agreeing with Dr. Horton with an acceleration later in the century that may exceed this range, particularly if there's oscillations in the ice sheets. Second, coastal adaptation involves both site-specific and broadly generic principles. Two objectives. Identify several scales of information resources for the Southeast U.S. and Caribbean. I really focused on this first objective. Tony and some others made it clear to me that there's a real interest in information resources. Second objective, summarize some fundamental approaches to adaptation planning and emerging alternatives, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. Next.
Are you able to see the slide, Ken?
It just came in.
Okay, sorry about that.
Towards resources. After a decades of trying to organize paper and PDF information on sustainable coastal management, and more recently reading about cloud computing, that is, select websites that can act as hard drives to store specific information, approximately 7 months ago, a graduate student of mine, Hyun Yu, and I created at FIT, our university, a website that serves as a virtual archive of papers on coastal climate adaptation. The URL is on the bottom right. There are currently approximately 650 PDFs uploaded that are literally available at your fingertips, and more are added as we can. This is pro bono. Currently, we have 13 primary archive folders. You see them on the left in the blue box. These folders contain approximately 80 geographic subfolders. Next, please. Is it on your screen?
Yes, they've been coming up almost instantaneously on my end. I do apologize.
Okay, they're not coming up on mine. I'm going to go to the PDFs, the actual PowerPoint show I have. Okay, so on the next slide, and I don't have it on my, it just came in on the webinar. Okay, on the next slide, for example, to utilize this resource to obtain information, if you put your cursor over one of the 13 folders on the left. In this case, the red box is on U.S. National and Canada. If you put your cursor over that region, a push-out box will occur to the right. You can see a push-out box there that has 9 folders, U.S. EPA reports through Canada, National, and Arctic. If you then click whichever one of those regions is of interest to you, you will then go directly to a page that gives you all of the PDFs currently uploaded, any of which you can look at or instantly save to your desktop with the right click. Examples in this slide show for the US EPA reports, there is a box in the middle top that shows a large array of US EPA reports, many of which have been generated by Jim Titus and his team over 2 decades. The next example is for the U.S. Pew Climate Center reports. Pew has a Center for Climate Change Research and Policy, which is very productive. We have the majority of those reports either posted or soon to be posted. There are many. There are many, many other reports that operate at the U.S. national scale, and the final box in the bottom right shows that. Under the other U.S. national reports. In total, we have, I believe, well over 100 reports in the U.S. national and Canada macro directory. And as you can see on the top right, EPA has a Climate Ready Estuaries program, which has been supporting significant climate adaptation work around the country. Next, please. Multiple documents are available that summarize on the website that summarize state-scale sea level rise and coastal climate adaptation planning. docs exist that are useful in this regard from Pew, the Coastal States Organization, and NOAA Sea Grant. Three of them are shown there with their names on the archives. If one is beginning to seriously examine an adaptation planning exercise in your local or sub-regional community, it might be very useful to first examine some of the national scale information. Again, these reports are examples of reports that summarize what's been done state by state. Next, please. And they're all downloadable instantly. Though the focus of this presentation is not on federal scale adaptation planning, we have many, many, many dozens of new and old federal scale climate change adaptation and planning documents. This is a very recent example. This is a March 2010 study by Pew, the Pew Center for Global Climate Change, with a variety of suggestions for potential next steps in federal adaptation planning. Next. Let's telescope in a little bit. Now, looking at Florida, if one were looking at the website and you put your cursor over U.S. Florida, a pushout box would arise to the right with four subregional folders to choose from. If you were to click the statewide Florida folder in underlined in red, you will see approximately 40 PDFs available, as you can see there. I have on the far right highlighted four of them. These are not meant to be more important or more special than the others. These are just examples of the wide diversity and very significant reports that are available. The second one, called Protecting Florida's Communities, the Department of Community Affairs in 2005, is an extraordinary document. That's the second one on the far right. There's an image of it. Thank you. The one right below it is a remarkable report from 1990 on SLR incorporation into comprehensive planning by Ernie Estevez, a very, very good scientist and policy thinker at MOAT. And then the bottom one by Michael Volk is a very, very interesting piece of work as well. Actually, that's a PowerPoint show where he has another document that's his actual master's thesis that is elsewhere in the archives and is actually the primary document to look at. Next, please. You might recall from the last slide, we were looking at state-level reports for Florida. There were three other sub-regional categories one can search in, and these are what is available currently in these other categories. Text on the top of this slide is significant. A growing number of site-specific coastal climate planning adaptation reports are becoming available in Florida. Some of the examples are underlined below. This is not intended to be comprehensive. If your report is not underlined, it's not because it's not important. Interestingly, as I indicated, Estevez in 1990 estimated that approximately 14 local governments made reference to sea level rise in their comprehensive plans. When I first saw this, I was surprised, as this seems higher than I think many of us would have estimated for over 20 years ago. Sea level rise adaptation language is potentially being brought into several comprehensive plans currently, including work occurring here in Satellite Beach in East Central Florida and elsewhere as well. I'm hesitant to name other places because I don't know the processes that well. If you look at some of the underlined documents below, again, any one of these is a right click away from being on your desktop. And there is a great array of very useful studies occurring now in the Gulf Coast, the Charlotte Harbor, the Punta Gorda studies. There's the Key West work by TNC and Chris Berg in the Florida Keys. the East Coast mainland of Florida has a variety of studies as well, and some of them are very site-specific. Again, there's the actual paper by Volk, 2008, from Palm Beach County, one of many good things available. Next, please. I should mention that in doing this, I think myself and others have been surprised by how much actually is out there. The archive, the virtual archive, extends far beyond the U.S. and Florida. As you can see in this slide, we have highlighted what you would see if you were to put your cursor over the Latin America and Caribbean directory on the far left. 12 sub-regional directories would pop up. Whichever one you click, you will get the PDFs we currently have uploaded. In the examples, underlined, we have immediately above the cursor, we have Mexico. Thank you, Tony, for running the cursor. We have what's currently uploaded for Mexico. To the right, we have what's currently uploaded for the regional Caribbean. These are articles that operate at a regional scale. A tremendous amount of thinking and vetting has had to go into how to logically structure the placement of these articles. What we found is that, as you may gather from the prior slides, many of these things, many of the reports are regional in scale. We are not going to have time, but if you look at the far left under the archives, we have similar levels of detail available for Europe, Australia, New Zealand, the Middle East, Asia, the Pacific Islands. I believe there's over 10 sub-regional folders for Asia and the Indian Ocean. We don't have as many PDFs uploaded into the subfolders as we do for the Western Hemisphere, but we're getting there. We right now have over 200 PDFs not in the library that we simply have not had time to finish vetting and processing and upload. Next, please. I'm going to really jump through the Caribbean and not give it the time I'd like to give. There are some very interesting comparative adaptation exercises that we are engaged in here, do not have time to present on, perhaps down the road. For example, however, in the Mexican coast of Caribbean, in the Mexican coast bordering the Caribbean, the northernmost black point and the top of that map to the left is Cancun. Cancun is the largest Caribbean tourism destination, 5 million folks a year visit Cancun. When you're dealing with Caribbean countries and sea level rise planning, a paramount issue for everybody is the role of tourism, at least as important as in Florida. So tourism issues are driving many of the planning activities that are or are not present. For example, on the picture on the far right, there's a corridor south of Cancun called the Riviera Maya, wherein dozens of massive hotels at a scale that we don't see even in Florida have been put in very low elevation areas in porous limestone geological landscapes. As you can see there, many of these developments have over 1,000 and in some cases 2,000 units. And a couple miles inland of these developments, the bottom picture shows the worker housing that's put in. The Mexican government has been bringing unemployed folks from around the country to work in the tourism industry in Cancun South, with a typical ratio of 15 to 17 workers per individual hotel room as the employment ratio that they operate by. So there's been tremendous recent development that's continued to extend down the coast of the Caribbean, Mexico. And to date, I have been able to find limited information on the degree to which sea level rise and coastal climate adaptation has been brought into the local planning. The NGOs have been trying, but there's been a reluctance to undercut any of the short-term and very significant and important for Mexico economic gain from this massive coastal development. It will be interesting to see how this plays out, as again, the geology here is karst. There's going to be a wide array of issues as we approach the middle and end of the century in this area. Next, please. There is significant climate adaptation planning happening throughout the Caribbean, including in Mexico. An example of CARIBSES and other organizations often funded externally is on the left, one of their adaptation profiles. There's a big focus on public participation when possible. Next, please. Okay, in terms of the second objective of the study, I will now very briefly try to fly through some fundamental approaches to adaptation planning and emerging alternatives. Next, please. It's important to recognize up front that adaptation infrastructure is complex anywhere, varies among regions, and many different goals can influence planning. This slide from Maryland DNR shows just some of the different sectors, governmental, economic, and other that can influence adaptation planning. And those are not all of the pieces of the puzzle. Next, please. There's a variety of paradigms, proposals, rubrics on how to do adaptation planning. A common theme you see on the top left, there's a circular iterative process involving identifying threats, inventorying at-risk systems, characterizing risk of those systems and assets, developing adaptation strategies, implementing preliminary strategies, etc., typically with an iterative reassessment at some timeline. An example of a similar approach, not as graphically circular, is on the right, as the bottom table titled Sector-Based Adaptation emphasizes. On top of this, you have great variability in terms of different stressors, their vulnerability, and asset-specific adaptation strategies depending on the affected sectors. I think the text on the bottom left summarizes this adequately. There are simply many approaches to adaptation planning. Generic principles can be customized according to site-specific attributes and goals. Certainly using the virtual library and other resources available, it is possible to get a very strong handle on a great diversity of approaches and then telescope it into your specific area from there. Next, please. ICLEI has been mentioned before. They're worth mentioning again. Their resources for beginning an adaptation exercise are really substantive. They are local government developed and centric. They have a wide array of resources. At the macro regional scale in Southeast Florida on the bottom left, the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact involving four major counties, Broward, Dade, Palm Beach, Martin, has certainly been using a variety of the ICLEI materials. Next, please. ICLEI has a rubric that is useful and is available from various sources. There are 10 keys to sustainability planning. I'm not going to go through all of this, but there are multiple milestones, making the initial commitment, conducting an initial assessment, establishing sustainability goals, these are the items in bold, developing your local plan, implementing the policies. Obviously, there are many subcomponent steps during this process. This is one of many rubrics that are out there. I must mention that key number four, develop a sea level threat analysis. That was a modification I was making in an earlier draft. I would now phrase that as develop a coastal climate change threat analysis. Next, please. Adaptation exercises are workshop-driven exercises, certainly in the beginning, as many of the things we do in our workshop culture. Some workshops can be less painful than others. The reason I put this up here is there was recently a workshop here in East Central Florida. I actually could not attend, but was able to see the agenda. And I just wanted to point out that if you are in the process of building or operating adaptation workshops, I thought these color graphics on the actual agenda were useful. In the top right, there's an actual adaptation rubric that shows the steps of the adaptation process. And then as the days proceeded, the little boxes in colors provided a color-coded key so that the people attending the workshop actually were kept on the same page, in theory at least. This helps herd the cats, keep people focused so they don't know where they are in the process. I thought this was just a useful real-world approach to actually running a workshop. Next, please. Frequently, and we're closing, frequently in adaptation planning, coastal adaptation planning, you hear reference to, well, the primary options are to, bullet one, protect, bullet two, accommodate, bullet three, retreat. There are other categories of large alternative sets that are sometimes put out there, including attack. We don't have time to get into the detail of all of this, perhaps down the road. This is from Lynn Carter, and actually a webinar she did in the same series in January. It's a nice overview of these macro scale principles. A comment on the phrase retreat. A variety of folks are also using the phrase withdrawal or managed withdrawal for reasons that are relatively self-evident. Nonetheless, the reality is that the local through federal level, all three of these categories are at play, particularly the first two in the near term. Look to see the latter category to be increasing in significance through time. Next, please. I'm not going to go into detail on this, but simply planning should consider both chronic and episodic impacts of coastal climate change and sea level rise. The left box is an example of a chronic change, saltwater intrusion in the response of the Southwest Florida Water Management District summary. And the right box shows an example of an episodic impact. I'm not saying Hurricane Andrew was caused by climate change. The point is, hurricanes are episodic, and there's a lot of evidence that the frequency and potential intensity, or vice versa, depending on the expert, does correlate with climate change. Pre-disaster planning is preferable to post-disaster planning. However, since much of the focus is on post-disaster planning, we should view such planning as an opportunity to retrofit planning to respond for the long term. And in doing post-disaster planning, that's probably not the right time to be doing BAU, that is business as usual planning, for lots of planning, infrastructure, environmental, and increasingly economic reasons, certainly in Florida. Next, please. Adaptive planning is not different from sustainable coastal planning goals sought by many before climate change and sea level rise were more acceptable to discuss. We're in a wonderful window where we can much more frequently and in greater detail bring these issues onto the table. The chronic undervaluation of risk is becoming less tenable. There are many, many recent examples of this on many scales. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Investing millions now, however painful, or can certainly, through time, save millions, billions, or perhaps even a trillion or more in certain parts of the country. Therefore, the following two issues, often underrepresented in the literature, should be more explicitly considered for fully developed and effective coastal climate planning. A, the promotion of density and infrastructure increases in flood zones should not continue at past rates, and should surface as an explicit adaptation issue that receives the level of discussion applied to other issues. We need to confront the issue of longstanding BAU policies to increase density and infrastructure in flood zones however we can. Second, strategic withdrawal, also called managed retreat, should surface more frequently as an explicit adaptation issue, receiving the level of discussion applied to other issues. This issue, this approach, not tasteful, but there are ways to begin to go down this path, will be forced upon us through time, and it would be better to be prepared rather than to be responding reactively instead of proactively. Next, please. Hickley, in their major Preparing for Climate Change book, says this as much, where the red arrow points to one of the adaptation strategies they have bulleted out for stormwater and floodwater management. Next, please. Finally, good businesses engage in risk management, beginning, middle, and end of the pipe. As we go further into this highly dynamic century, it would seem logical for coastal planning to borrow and deploy risk management procedures that have been in place in industry and in the military and other endeavors for many decades. Next, please. Thank you for attending. There's some folks there that are acknowledged, and Ben and I are available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. That was excellent. And I would like to also just reiterate how great that your Sea Level Rise library is. It's so excellent. And I, in all the research that I've done, I have not seen one website that really draws together all the information you'd ever need to be able to really get a good grasp on what's going on. So can you give people that URL again?
Yes, thank you. The URL is http://research.fit.edu/, Sea Level Rise Library. So to make it simple, you don't do www, you just say research.fit.edu/Sea Level Rise Library.
Great. And for folks who are writing that down, I found a slide here that has it at the bottom for you to write down. And again, this presentation, the audio, and the PDFs of these presentations will be available on SACE's website, hopefully by tomorrow, cleanenergy.org, under multimedia, then under archived webinars. And thank you both so much for taking time out of your lives. I know you all have lots of things going on. And so I'd like to take, you know, I know we're over time, but, I, you know, if people would like to stay on, that's great. We have a list of questions here, and I will go ahead and start with the first question here. This one's from Rhonda. Rhonda is asking, how much sea level rise would be possible from thermal expansion only without any additional volume from melting?
Well, the answer to that would be to look at the 20th century record, and approximately 30 to 40% of the 1.8 millimeters is due to thermal expansion, and the rest is from alpine glaciers. The important point about thermal expansion is how spatially variable it is. It's very, one of the things that we're aware of by looking at satellite images of the globe is how spatially variable thermal expansion is. So just sort of to give you a sort of a broad scale. So if we look at the period from 1993 to 2003, if we look at the satellite images, and I've got a global map in front of me, the rate of thermal expansion to do with sea level rise in the western part of the Pacific is some 12 millimeters per year. Huge amount. on the Atlantic coast of the U.S., there's a slight hot spot around Florida. There's a spatial gradient that's been observed. There's a hot spot around Florida and a cool spot around Delaware, Newfoundland, etc. So the contribution to sea level from thermal expansion around Florida is around, 1.5 to 2 millimeters, whereas in Delaware, it's actually, Delaware, it's around zero, and if you go up to Maine and Newfoundland, it's actually negative. So its contribution is around 30 to 40% global average, but the important point is this spatial variability. And I will say that it is very hard to project that into the future, what the spatial variability is, and we are unable to do that. And that's why you get these projections from the IPCC that are global means, or from Ramsdorf, global means.
Thank you for that. Next question is, has there ever been any discussion to contain the ice sheet meltwater because it's a freshwater and valuable resource? Do either of you know that answer?
There have been some, I've seen some thoughts about to do with the Middle East, which has A, a large amount of money, and also B, water shortages, that they were going to take calving icebergs from Antarctica and take it all the way to the Middle East. But I think that was sort of like a pie in the sky thought.
Okay, thank you. Another question here. Is the data on isostatic change in sea level rise for Mexico, is there data on isostatic change in sea level rise for Mexico and or the Caribbean?
There are model projections. And so one of the slides that I was thinking about showing, but I already ran over, but it's another topic of my research, is to compare our geological observations with what are called geophysical isostatic projections. And what we find is that our observations and the models are great because they give you a global coverage, but they're not particularly accurate on a regional level. Furthermore, the models have about a 1,000-year time step, so they only give you what's happening to isostasy at 4,000, 3,000, 2,000, rather than the sort of distribution of data points that I have. But you can get those projections and tell you exactly what the isostatic rates are for everywhere in the globe, but they need to be taken with sort of with a pinch of salt in the fact that they aren't that accurate regionally or temporally, but they do give you a broad scale feeling for what's happening to the land. And you can get that information off what is called the Proudman Oceanographic Laboratory. So if you type in Proudman Oceanographic Laboratory, and then they have what is called the Mean Sea Level Service. And it's basically a map where it has where you just put in your GPS coordinates where you're interested in, and it can give you what the isostatic land level movements are.
Great, thank you. This question is for Ken. Ken, for someone who would want to engage their elected officials into what you're doing, what would you recommend for folks to do? Should they send a link? Is there a way that give like a compilation document that would be the best thing to send to an elected official about sea level rise and adaptation?
My suggestion would be to use whatever resources are available, to spend a couple hours examining the information specific to that area and then scaling up. If one had a couple of hours, if one's going to make a serious pitch at an elected official, that would substantially increase the chances of success. With the virtual archive, it would be possible to use the Google search tool to drill in geographically or topically on the angle one wanted to use with that elected official. One might find, subsequent to doing an hour's worth of research, perhaps two, the document that works for them. There are a really surprising amount of strong documents. I and others have been consistently surprised at how much is actually out there and is now readily available. Most of this is very new, but there is a explosive literature that's going to only increase in frequency on this. And I'm not talking about only the science. This is the policy. So to close, I'm hesitant to recommend one magic document. I think that with an hour's worth of searching, a hell of a memo could be generated in one page with reference to the web links and or an appendix with key tables or summary bullets using a library. If someone wants to follow up, they can feel free to contact me at lindeman@fit.edu.
Thanks, Ken. And we just have time for one more question before we wrap up here. And so if anyone has a question, go ahead and chat it in. But I would like to just ask Ken to maybe discuss how people, if they see a document or they have a PDF of a document they think might be worthy of being included on your website, should they send that directly to you?
That would be great. We are always soliciting documents. Most of them we've gone out and found. If you go to the homepage of the website, on the bottom, there's a section called Submissions. You can click an email address. That address is slrlibrary, one word, @fit.edu. Or you don't have to remember it. Just go to the homepage, click it, and please send us whatever you've got. We are... there's a mixture of pleasure and fear at the number of new documents that are being generated right now. And the more they're sent to us, the easier it is, obviously, for us to find them. We would particularly appreciate documents that are typically not available and or documents in foreign languages. We truly do cover every coastline on the planet. And if anyone has access to documents in native languages, we're particularly interested. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. And we're out of time, and I would like to thank everyone who participated today. Again, the audio portion of this webinar and the PowerPoints in a PDF format will be available on SACE's website. If you're looking at your screen still, I'd just like to point out another thing on Ken's site here, where in the middle of the screenshot, it says webinars on climate adaptation and planning. Not only does Ken post our webinars, but also other opportunities. So I would definitely check his website frequently. And thanks so much, Dr. Lindeman and Dr. Horton, for sharing your information with us today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.